running. The psalm that was read, Psalm 30, in some ways is a psalm that goes directly to the heart of the human condition, in some ways at least. It's a psalm that addresses David's fear of death and David's sense that he's been brought from the threshold of death by God. In many of the versions of the Bible that you'll find, individual psalms are sometimes prefaced by a title or of some kind, or a hint of the purpose or the content of the psalm. In the online version of the New Revised Standard Version, which is the one that we tend to use here at MFM, Psalm 30 is introduced with the words, "Thanksgiving for recovery from grave illness." The American Standard Version introduces it with "Thanksgiving for deliverance from death." And many of the other versions simply introduce it as a Psalm of David, a Psalm of Deliverance, dedication of the temple. And it is clearly a Psalm of Thanksgiving. And there are multiple references to things like healing or deliverance from the grave, death, mourning, etc. It's also a fairly typical Psalm of David, in which he sees his healing as a vindication of some sort and a way of preventing his foes from rejoicing at his death. And I struggle a little bit with psalms like that, in part because the whole "don't let them gloat over my death" kind of line strikes me as petty and self-serving. In other words, you know, my pride won't let me accept that my death will be welcomed by some. Now, I do understand that David is writing these words as king of Israel, and so his death from illness may reflect badly on the nation and their trust in God, and it may weaken their standing in the eyes of the surrounding nations. I get that. But at the same time, I can't shake the impression that there's more of a personal interest here on David's part than a concern for the reputation of the nation. He doesn't make any direct reference to the welfare of Israel, but he does argue that God will somehow be diminished should he, David, die. He says, "What profit is there in my death? If I go down to the pit, will the dust praise you? Will it tell of your faithfulness?" he asks. And to my mind, that line of questioning betrays a certain level of arrogance with regard to the importance of David to God, perhaps. And a bit of an unflattering image of God as someone who needs flattery and the ego stroking that he gets from someone like David. But on the other hand, I think there are two elements of this kind of negotiation, this bartering with God, the attempt to convince God that God would be better off to let me live than to let me die, that I find enlightening. First of all, it's a very common human reflex to want to barter with God in times of great difficulty. "I'll do this for you if you'll do that for me." We may not phrase it as crassly as that, and we may not directly barter with God in the way that I just did, but we do tend to fall back on this kind of pattern when the challenges of life feel overwhelming. Most of you will be familiar with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and David Kessler, who highlight this tendency in their work on grief and grieving in dealing with important losses. And most of you will be familiar with their five stages of grief: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then finally acceptance. The bargaining stage, of course, is where we try to manipulate our way out of the pain of the loss. "I'll do this if that can change." It's very human and very understandable. We recognize the value of what's at risk, whether that may be our own health, our own life, or the life of a loved one, and we try to find ways of protecting it by promising something in exchange for its protection. So on that level, I think David's simply expressing in his own way what any other human being might feel in similar circumstances. He doesn't want to die, and he's pleading to God for mercy. But the other component of his bargaining with God that I find intriguing is his reference to Sheol and the pit. You brought up my soul from Sheol, restored me to life from among those gone down to the pit. He's basically declaring in this psalm that God has raised him from the dead, in a, at least in a metaphorical sense. And at the very least, he's been brought back from death's door. And that interests me, along with his insistence on the fact that his death will be of no profit to God. There's a finality to this attitude towards death that left me wondering about the developing understanding of what death meant in Jewish thought. And so I dug a bit into the meaning of these terms, Sheol and the pit. And some translations simply take these words, I mean, Sheol is the Hebrew word, simply take these words and render them as the grave. And the implication apparently being that what David has in mind is simply the end of life, the final resting place of the living. And that seems to be a fairly legitimate translation of Sheol, but it's not the only one, or at least it's not the only way of understanding all of the nuance of the possibilities of this word. And there are all kinds of theories around the etymology of the word, where it comes from, and its underlying meaning, and how it might best be translated. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia, for example, has no less than 6 explanations of how the word Sheol fits into the Old Testament text and how it's used. First one being that, according to this Bible Encyclopedia, the Old Testament contains no afterlife belief at all until the 3rd or 2nd century BC. In all of the time before that, Sheol in the older texts means simply the grave, to which all people, good or bad, go after death and where no conscious existence is lived. Number 2, the Old Testament imagines a shadowy, semi-conscious continuing of life of some sort in a place where all people go after death, and Sheol is this place. Number 3, Sheol, meaning in effect the next world, is divided into 2 compartments. And these descriptions are taken from various texts in the Old Testament that make reference to Sheol. So the lower compartment has 2 compartments, to one of which everyone goes upon earthly death. The lower compartment is a place of miserable existence, either shadowy or otherwise, while the upper compartment is where the good dwell as they await the resurrection. Number 4, only bodies go to Sheol, while souls, at least those of the righteous, go to heaven. Number 5, Sheol is a nether world inhabited by demons and some or all of the dead who live in an existence divorced from, and for demons at least, in opposition to the purposes of God and those who live on the earth. And finally, number 6, Sheol is a term used in at least 2 different ways, one simply being death and the grave, and the other being the next life. So that, you know, it's a fairly complex set of understandings. The encyclopedia then goes on to underline that it must be noted, and I'm quoting here, it must be noted that nowhere in the Old Testament is Sheol described as a place of torment or punishment for the wicked. At most, it's a place of confinement away from the land of the living at this stage. So then I thought, well, okay, that's fine. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia has that to say about it. I went to the Jewish Encyclopedia to see what I might glean from their thinking. And this is an old encyclopedia that was actually finished about 100 years ago and is now available online because it's no longer under copyright. And I'm Scottish enough that free access to resources is right up my line. So the Jewish Encyclopedia does the same thing. It takes the various scriptures that make reference to Sheol or the grave or death and fleshes them out a bit and defines some of the characteristics of Sheol with examples drawn from these biblical texts. And I won't cite most of the biblical references, but if you Google Jewish Encyclopedia and then do a search for Sheol, you'll find everything you need. So number 1, it connotes the place where those that had died were believed to be congregated. And that's the word they use, where those who have died have been congregated. And I really like this use of this image of the congregation of the dead. And as an example, they say that Jacob, who refused to be comforted at the news that his son Joseph was dead, says, "I'll go down to my son, a mourner, into Sheol." Number two, they stipulate that Sheol, as described, is under the earth. Number three, it is very deep. And in fact, it marks the point at the greatest possible distance from heaven. Number four, the dead descend or are made to go down into it, and the revived ascend or brought up and lifted up from it. Number five, there are lots of them. Number five, sometimes the living are hurled into Sheol before they would naturally have been claimed by it. There's a reference to a passage where the earth opens up and swallows certain people. Sheol, number six, is spoken of as a land, but ordinarily it is a place with gates and seems to have been viewed as being divided into compartments, as the other one suggested, with the farthest corners one beneath the other. Number seven, it's a place where the dead meet. Without distinction of rank or condition, the rich and the poor, the pious and the wicked, the old and the young, the master and the slave, if the reference in Job chapter 3 is a reference to Sheol, and the thinking is that it is. Number eight, the dead continue after a fashion their early life. Jacob, as we said earlier, would go down to Sheol to mourn. David abides there in peace. Warriors have their weapons with them, yet they're mere shadows. Number nine, the dead merely exist in Sheol without knowledge or feeling. Number 10, silence reigns there, and oblivion is the lot of them that enter therein. Hence it's known also as Duna, the abode of silence, and there God is not praised. Number 11, still on a certain extraordinary occasions, the dwellers in Sheol are credited with the gift of making known their feelings of rejoicing at the downfall of the enemy. David is in this gang, I suppose. Sleep is their usual lot. Sheol is a horrible, dreary, dark, disorderly land, and yet it is the appointed house for all the living, eventually. Return from Sheol is not expected. It's described as man's eternal house. And as per Psalm 30 that was read this morning, it is dust. Will the dust praise you? David asks in the song. The Encyclopedia Britannica, also available online free of charge, has this to say about Sheol. The place did not conjure up images of an afterlife, for nothing happened there. It was literally inconceivable, and this is what made it frightening. Death was utterly definitive, even if rather ill-defined. A five-year-old once asked me, or once said to me, "You know, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I'm wondering, what happens when you die?" I'm not sure what brought up that question, or why this had been a matter of some thought and deliberation for this child. And I was also caught a little bit off guard by the question. But knowing the child's parents and their thinking on that particular point and not wanting to be too directly in conflict with them with an answer that allowed for no other possibility, I answered that, well, some people believe that when your body dies, your spirit lives on and goes to heaven to be with God. To which the five-year-old answered, "Yeah, but I don't believe in God, so that can't be right." Okay, maybe. So then I said, "Yeah, okay. Other people believe that when you die, you are reborn in another existence as another person." To which the five-year-old responded, "Yeah, I used to believe that, but not anymore. It doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense." Head shaking in disbelief. So then the child looked at me in the eye and said, "You know what I think? I think that when you die, you go like this." And that's the end of it. That's most of the Old Testament understanding of the effect of death. One dies, and that's the end of it as far as any meaningful existence is concerned. So when David praises God for deliverance from death, that's a major sigh of relief. I can go on living for a few years yet. And his statement that God has turned my mourning into dancing is partly because he is literally now able to dance again. Life goes on. And I suspect that the final line of his psalm, I will give thanks to you forever, will hold true until the next crisis, at which point David will again plead for his life and try to convince God that it is not yet his time. But this official, if you like, understanding of what happens when you die, that you simply cease to exist in any meaningful way, while perhaps being relatively acceptable as a theological position, is also paired in the Old Testament with a sense, or a conviction even, that God will reward the righteous here and now, and will punish the unrighteous here and now. And that understanding of God's justice flies in the face of most of our lived experience. It also flies in the face of the lived experience of many of the Old Testament prophets who recognize that God's justice is not always being meted out in the here and now. So by the time we get to the New Testament, Jewish understanding of death is evolving. The idea that there will be an ultimate resurrection of all people and a final judgment on the righteous and the unrighteous is embraced by the Pharisees, although it's rejected by the Sadducees, who are the priestly caste. And following the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD and the disappearance of the priestly role in Jerusalem and the sacrificial acts, the rabbinical view becomes the dominant Jewish position. God will resurrect the dead at the end of time for a final judgment so that justice can finally be seen to have been done. And this was certainly Paul's position as a good Pharisee and a new follower of Jesus. And it was certainly the belief adopted by the early church and brought forward through our various creeds and confessions of faith. Our own confession of faith in a Mennonite perspective deals with the question of death and resurrection in the final article. And I won't read the full article because I actually have some issues with some of the ways some of the sentences are formulated and some of the ideas are brought forward. But I would like to finish this meditation by reading those parts that I think are relevant. And let me also point out that our confession of faith pairs the question of death and resurrection with the question of how we are to live our lives in the here and now. It's article number 24, the reign of God. We place our hope in the reign of God and in its fulfillment in the day when Christ, our ascended Lord, will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. We believe in God's final victory, in the end of this present age of struggle between good and evil, in the resurrection of the dead, and in the appearance of a new heaven and a new earth. Faithful Israel acclaimed God as King and looked forward to the fullness of God's kingdom. We affirm that in Jesus' ministry, death, and resurrection, the time of fulfillment has begun. In his life and teaching, he showed that God's reign included the poor, the outcasts, the persecuted, those who are like children, and those with faith like a mustard seed. We believe that the church is called to live now according to the model of the future reign of God. Thus, we're given a foretaste of the kingdom that God will one day establish in full. The church is to be a spiritual, social, and economic reality, demonstrating now the justice, righteousness, love, and peace of the age to come. We believe that just as God raised Jesus from the dead, we also will be raised from the dead. And we look forward to the coming of a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem, where the people of God will no longer hunger, thirst, or cry, but will sing praises To the one seated on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and might forever and ever.